Hello. Would you please start by telling me your full name, the date, the time, and your location?
Kit, can you hear me?
I just couldn't hear you, but I can hear you now. Can you still hear me?
I'm hardwired to the internet, but your signal keeps coming in and out.
That seems likely.
But anyway, go ahead and ask the question again, and we'll try again.
All right. Would you please start by telling me your full name, the date, the time, and your location?
Yeah, my name is Peter Gold. The date is December 2nd. The time is 2:08 p.m. Eastern Time, and my location is Avon, Connecticut.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial, share alike?
I do consent, yes.
Thank you. All right. Could you start by introducing yourself to anyone who's going to be listening to this? What might you want someone listening to understand about you and the position that you're speaking from?
Okay, great. I am currently the senior staff person for the American Institute of Homeopathy. The American Institute of Homeopathy is the oldest medical society in the United States, predating the American Medical Association by approximately 3 years. I have served the homeopathic community in a variety of capacities over the last 15 or so years, helping the National Center for Homeopathy, the Academy of Veterinary Homeopathy, the Canadian Academy of Homeopathy, and other organizations, particularly with respect to research, communications, and outreach. I'm a biologist by training. I have been involved with homeopathy since the late 1990s, very extensively. I've trained to better understand homeopathy. It's actually spent 15 years training in the field, so I understand its the practice of homeopathy very well. And I think that pretty well covers it.
Great. What have been some of the most significant issues on your mind since March 2020?
Great question. So one of the things I have focused on in my career in homeopathy is the history of medicine. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I have been quite fascinated with the epidemiological evidence around different modalities and their effectiveness during deadly epidemics, particularly in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. One of the things that struck me as perhaps the most interesting is how well homeopaths seem to do throughout those deadly periods as compared to ordinary medicine and other practices of medicine. Very low mortality rates as compared to those other modalities, and very low mortality rates when compared to those who went without treatment. So the untreated as well as those treated by other modalities didn't do as well from a mortality standpoint as those treated with homeopathy. So that got me thinking. March rolled around, that being my background, mm-hmm. a worldwide pandemic breaks loose, and it occurred to me that it would be a good time to engage the international homeopathic community to see if we could track how homeopaths were faring in the pandemic, how their patients, more importantly, were faring during this pandemic at all stages of the disease. And so I set up in March for the American Institute of Homeopathy an automated data collection tool that was built from scratch that would allow us to capture key information about the individuals treated by homeopaths. And we, in creating that tool, sought to capture as much information as we could about the patient and the course of the disease, the severity of the disease, the symptoms of the disease that were, you know, individual to that, to each patient. We see homeopaths see all disease as an individual expression, not a global expression of a disorder. So each patient is treated individually. And so we created this tool and have been tracking the work of about 200, roughly 200 homeopaths mm-hmm. around the world who have been treating patients at various stages of COVID-19.
And what have you been finding, if you have anything to share at this moment?
A number of things. One, to our great satisfaction, we have found that patients treated at any stage of the disease, treated homeopathically, respond very well and very quickly. But we've identified, when you start out, there are hundreds of remedies that could be given to anybody for whatever problem they might have. It's an individualized form of medicine. So we look at the symptom profile of the patient, the characteristic, seeking the characteristic symptoms of the patient. So in any pathology, there are common symptoms that, so if you and I have the flu, we have some sort of generalized common symptoms that are unique to that particular syndrome. But then there are characteristic symptoms. Your bronchitis might be expressed with a cough that gets much worse in cold air and is particularly severe when you lie on the right side. And, if you were to speak or sing or, do any number of things, that your symptoms would be worse. So in my case, I mean, it might be much worse in a warm room. I might be, thirstless during my bronchitis. I might, notice that when I'm coughing, I have tremendous head pain with the cough, with motion. So I'm worse when I move, whereas the other patient was much better at rest and so on and so forth. So what we do is we seek to understand what's characteristic about each patient's expression of disease. Mm-hmm. And I apologize, by the way, there's somebody apparently using a blower outside my window here briefly, so there'll be some background noise. But anyway, we look at what's unique, what's characteristic, and we find a remedy that has produced similar characteristic symptoms when given to a healthy volunteer. So you start out with a lot of remedies. You don't really know what to expect. We took hundreds and hundreds of cases. I think we're up to close to 1,000 cases taken now in this database. We've identified about 5 homeopathic remedies that seem to allow homeopaths to provide relief in about 70% of all cases. Mm-hmm. That remaining 25 to 30% of the cases require other remedies, but there are 5 remedies that we've identified that are sort of the common remedies to look at mm-hmm. when one has a COVID-19 confirmed patient in front of us. Mm-hmm. And of those 5, there is probably 1 or 2 in particular that are more likely than the rest to be helpful. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've seen so far. A cluster of 5 remedies that are helpful in about 70% of the cases, a number of other remedies that are helpful in the balance of those cases, quick resolution of symptoms, a significant reduction in post-COVID-19 syndrome cases, reduced mortality, virtually no hospitalization required for any of these patients, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So very, very interesting response, not inconsistent with what we saw through history in the great flu pandemic of 1918-1919, epidemics of yellow fever, cholera, diphtheria, scarlet fever, so on and so forth through the 19th century. Epidemic disease seems to respond quite well to the properly selected homeopathic remedy.
Mm-hmm. How does one properly select?
So as I mentioned a moment ago, COVID-19, the syndrome it's similar to any other sort of disease syndrome in that there are things that are common to somebody who's got COVID-19, just like there's things that are common to people with flu. For instance, you have a headache or you have a sore throat or you have body aches. Mm-hmm. What we do in homeopathy is we seek to go deeper. So we ask the patient a lot of questions to better understand how they're, as an individual, expressing their disease. Mm-hmm. So as I said earlier, how you express, how your body reacts when you have contracted, you know, bronchitis is different than how my body is going to cope with that problem. And so as we evaluate the patient, we carefully observe, we carefully question to understand, okay, what's unique in this case of COVID that Kit is presenting to me? Mm-hmm. Is she, you know, particularly worse on motion? Is she, you know, febrile at a particular time? Is she unusually thirsty or thirstless during, you know, some phase of her either fever or chills or whatever? Does she, has there been a marked change in her emotional state? Mm-hmm. So it's physical, emotional, mental. We look at all those dimensions to try to understand, are you sleeping differently?
Right.
Is your appetite changed? Are you craving something? Et cetera. And from that, we're able to garner, we usually can find without too much difficulty, if the case is well taken, 5 or 6 things that characterize your expression of your COVID-19 infection. And based on those characteristic symptoms, we then jump into a computer program that searches the homeopathic remedies. Homeopathic remedies have been tested against healthy volunteers, and we know the characteristics of the remedies based on the symptoms that they produce when those remedies are given to healthy volunteers in what's called proving. So I know that, you know, phosphorus or bryonia or arsenicum or aconite or whatever produces these particular characteristic symptoms. And if I see a patient with similar characteristics, I can have a high degree of confidence that that homeopathic medicine is going to have a helpful effect on the patient. It's a law of nature we refer to as like cures like. It's been known dating back to the very earliest of Chinese medicine. Hippocrates talked about it at great length in his writings as a method of cure. Hahnemann, who founded homeopathy, discovered in his translation work, he was a physician and a chemist, brilliant scientist in his day. He discovered that things that caused a set of symptoms could also cure those symptoms. He tested his theories for many years. He then began to publish about it. Hence was born this notion of like cures like, something that can cause disease, can cure it. And so when we see a COVID patient in front of us, we find those characteristic symptoms, we match it to a remedy using a sophisticated computer program, we administer the remedy, the administration of the remedy is a little bit complex in the sense that, what potency we give, how frequently we give it, again, that's individualized. But once we've identified a remedy, it's given to the patient, and then we await a response. We monitor the patient for a response to that remedy. And in the case of COVID-19 patients, we've seen that the properly chosen remedy provides relief to the patients that have been treated on a very rapid basis.
What do you remember about what you first heard when you first learned about COVID-19?
I've studied the 1918-19 pandemic extensively, as I have other epidemics that were treated homeopathically. And as it began to emerge, I have long felt that in my lifetime there would be a pandemic that matched, if not exceeded, the great pandemic of 1918-19. So as it began to emerge from Asia and spread, I felt that this could be a moment for homeopathy to emerge. Homeopathy has almost since its first moments faced strong opposition from other medical paradigms. And now there's really one dominant medical paradigm. It's an allopathic model or an allopathic paradigm. And it is, as a result, suppressed in the United States aggressively. And efforts to suppress it around the world have been equally aggressive, although probably in the United States, those that have sought to suppress it have had a greater effect. But so I thought, maybe this will be a moment where homeopathy can, as an adjunct to ordinary care, provide humanity with some relief from the horrible mortality rates that we witnessed in 1918-1919, that lives could be saved, that economies could be saved, that, suffering could be reduced. And so we, with some anticipation, got ready. And once it was clear that this was going to be a full-scale pandemic, as I said, we very rapidly, the American Institute of Homeopathy, I believe, was the first one to create a data collection effort that was international. So we launched on March 23rd to collect data and have continued to do so to this date.
How is that data being shared?
I share it through an international network of homeopathic organizations and have since the beginning. Sharing it goes both ways. There are other groups that are collecting data as well. In Asia and in Europe that share their data with us. A number of papers are being published that look at these various efforts. And there are several in final stages of publication now in various journals. And one other small piece of this, an algorithm was developed that would allow non-homeopaths to perhaps use homeopathy to treat patients. And that algorithm was turned into a piece of software that is downloadable to any PC, and people can plug in the symptoms that they're seeing in their patients. And the algorithm recommends the most likely remedy, though not necessarily the correct remedy, in that, it really focuses on those five most likely remedies that we have seen in our research. So it does not, for instance, if you're a case that might require lobelia, you're not going to, that algorithm is not going to tell you lobelia is the remedy you need. It's going to look among the five remedies that are most commonly employed with patients to see if the symptoms you're seeing in your patient in front of you right now might happen to gain some benefit from using one of those five remedies. But anyway, so it's internationally shared. We have been aggressive in our communications about this, in the sense that we've held webinars, particularly early in the pandemic, when the medical community was flat on its back and fighting for its survival, people dying at high rates, particularly in the United States and in Europe, and tried to provide our allopathic colleagues with the basic understanding of what was required to use homeopathy, and invited them to call on us. Sadly, not much of that happened, but we did work to provide that information regardless of that final outcome. We wanted to be as helpful as we could be when there was no vaccine, very few therapeutics, people were dying, horrific deaths of suffocation, very similar to the deaths people experienced in the 1918-1919 pandemic. People would be seemingly fine at the beginning of the day and suddenly become severely ill and pass quite quickly. And when their lungs were examined, they were, you know, there'd been tremendous hemorrhaging. And so it was different, but it's the same in its catastrophic effects. Mm-hmm. So we just, you know, we were ready to help. And we continue to have our faith in homeopathy reinforced because the patients that we have treated as a community have done extremely well. And even people in severe final stages of COVID-19 could be resuscitated with the proper homeopathic remedy, we were very pleased to be able to help a fair number of patients who were in very late stages of COVID in severe distress, so we're gratified, I guess is the word, to see that our system could help people even in the worst condition.
Are you able to talk about some of the medical practices that you've been using that you've been finding productive?
So again, it's any home, and a lot of these homeopaths, probably the vast majority, I'd guess 80%, maybe 90% of the people involved in this project are licensed medical professionals, mm-hmm. MDs. Primarily here in the United States and in Europe and Asia. We tried to track any other treatments that they might have been using to treat their patients. In the majority of cases, overwhelming majority of cases, the homeopathic physicians that were treating patients used only homeopathy to do so. Mm-hmm. There were no other modalities deployed or employed. And, you know, if the patient was taking some medications prior to seeing that physician, that homeopathic physician, that data was recorded. So we know in the database, you know, what were the comorbidities, what other drugs was the patient taking at the time? Are there any supplements that were given? So we have all that data in our data set. But for the most part, when somebody arrived for treatment with a homeopathic physician for COVID-19, they were only given homeopathic remedies as as the method of treatment.
What would be some examples of those remedies?
Well, so here's the challenge. You know, in any description of homeopathy, the thing that folks want to know is, you know, they'll read a case and it could be very complicated, and it might be a pneumonia case, or it might be who knows what, you know, but something dramatic. And they always want to know, what was the remedy? What, you know, because the mindset that we've all grown up with is that, you know, you give X for pathology Y. You know, mm-hmm. there's one size fits all. But I'm happy to list the remedies that were most commonly used, mm-hmm. with the caveat that just because these were really helpful with the majority of cases doesn't mean that they're helpful in every case, because they're right. Definitely not. Yeah. Bryonia alba was the, which made from a plant, is one of the earliest remedies discovered by Hahnemann, has proven to be extremely helpful across the globe. Sometimes in an epidemic or pandemic, you see that in Europe, one set of remedies would be particularly helpful, and, you know, a different set of remedies might work in Asia, or let's say the United States. A number of remedies are very helpful in the Northeast, but in the West, it seems a different set of remedies might be helpful. And that's at times due to the fact that mutations produce slightly different variations in a virus that's causing the kind of havoc that this one caused. But in any event, we found Brownia was probably helpful in more cases than any other remedy. Mm-hmm. And I will, hold on a second, I got to call up the list so I give you an order of their helpfulness, what we saw. So give me just 1 second. And I'll have that pulled up. Okay, so Brownia was number one. Arsenicum album is the second most often used remedy. Gelsemium was the next in line, followed by Pulsatilla, and finally Phosphorus.
Okay.
Now there are other as I said, there are other cases that had produced required different remedies, but Brownia and Arsenicum were Gelsemium were really the dominant trio, with Brownia being the leader of the pack by a fair margin.
And are those all internally administered?
Yeah. So homeopathic remedies are given most often in the form of a pellet, but they can be given in a liquid form as well, where you dissolve a pellet in some water. One of the things we're learning about homeopathy, there are labs all over the world, I think 13 or 15 now in total in Russia, France, Italy, India, and the United States, that are finding that every homeopathic remedy at every potency level have distinct nanoparticles in them that are unique to that particular remedy. Mm-hmm. So what we're really doing is administering the first known form of nanomedicine when we practice homeopathy, and more the literature is reflecting that. Mm-hmm. So each one of these pellets is embedded with nanoparticles of the original medicinal substance, and they're taken orally, either in pellet form or, as I said, dissolved in water and in teaspoon doses. The frequency of the dosing dependent upon the patient, the severity of the case. If you have a case that is ascending, an acute case where the severity is ascending rapidly, you're going to dose more frequently and at higher potencies. If you've got a case that's less severe, you would likely dose, less frequently, and the posology or the potencies could be a little bit lower on the scale, but. So pellet or in solution was the method of administration, but always orally.
Can you tell me what health means to you?
Freedom from, that's a great question. Health is freedom from symptoms that impair my intellectual, emotional, and physical mobility. So, the goal of homeopathy in any modality, I would assume, is to give people freedom from those things that would impair their full expression of their potential.
So what are some of the things you would like for your own health and for the health of those around you in this moment?
Again, that freedom from limitation, to be able to fully express my being in whatever way, I choose to move. I think that, and the same for those that I care about, And I don't know if I'm answering your question the way you hoped I would, but it's that simple, I think. It's Yeah, I think it's that simple. It's freedom from the impediment of physical, emotional, and mental obstructions.
Right. How do you think that we could work towards that as a society? Achieving that version of health or?
I think it starts, humankind is it's an interesting species. We claim to value health, and yet, you know, bring it back to homeopathy for a moment. If you look at the correspondence between the founders of the AMA, and they were organizing themselves with some alarm after the homeopathic community started the American Institute of Homeopathy, their organizational focus was in large part about exterminating their economic rivals, the homeopaths. It wasn't because homeopathy was a sham, and they stated this in their correspondence with each other. It was because homeopathy was threatening their individual practices. Their practices were drying up. Individual practitioners were suffering because people were moving away from organized medicine of the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and towards homeopathy because of the success homeopaths were having in these deadly epidemics. Mm-hmm. And the allopaths that formed the AMA wanted that to stop. So, you know, and to do that, they had to discredit this other system. And so I guess it would be nice to answer your question, if I remember it now that I got off on a track, is that, you know, we value health more than riches, than treasure. And if we valued health more than treasure, there'd be an openness to looking at ideas that seem to fall outside a given paradigm. If there's evidence to suggest that other system could offer value, could save lives, reduce suffering. And unfortunately, we've got a system now that where it's never really, going back to homeopathy, it's never been a battle about science, though those that have sought to diminish homeopathy have made that claim. It's been very much, as you can find yourself if you look at the correspondence between the founders of the AMA, a battle, and going forward, a battle for dollars. And if we could end the battle for dollars and sort of rebalance our values and put health above financial gain, I think wonderful things could happen. Will that ever happen? I don't know. Humankind being what it is, motivated by the things that motivates it, I'm not sure. But that would be my dream, that, you know, we could look at that a homeopath could arrive. We were treating people in the earliest stages, we were treating people outside of Paris. Mm-hmm. The homeopaths who were elderly, locked in nursing homes, which were killing fields, as you know. Mm-hmm. I lost my mom to COVID in a nursing home in May. And I was unable to see her at any time. I couldn't have gotten her a remedy if I wanted to. She was locked down. It happened that in some instances in France, there were homeopaths that were leading the medical teams in nursing homes and were able to use homeopathy to save dozens of, you know, desperately sick seniors. Mm-hmm. And if we'd had an opportunity to present that information, those cases, and you know, gather together as a community of physicians, I think, you know, we could have saved a lot of lives, avoided a massive economic meltdown, and, you know, maybe bought time for allopaths to develop their vaccines and their other therapies. But anyway, it didn't happen that way, despite the death toll, despite the economic impact. And it shows again that one paradigm has got a lock hold on our thinking, and they have a lock hold on our thinking for a lot of reasons, not the least of which they spend a lot of money, to maintain that hold. But anyway, had we had a different mindset, I really believe homeopathy and homeopaths could have contributed, adjunct solutions that would have saved the lives of nurses and doctors and their patients from the very first moments of this pandemic. Didn't happen. And maybe it'll never happen, but I'm a bit of an optimist. I'm still hopeful that someday we'll get there.
You mentioned that you are in Connecticut. What have the restrictions been like where you are?
Depends on the time of the year. So as was true for the nation as a whole, we were locked down for the first 8 weeks, I would say. I don't even remember exactly now, but and there was great fear in the community. Everybody was gripped by this sense that there was this ether, something in the ether that you could catch, was sort of with serendipity, had more to do with it than anything else, and that it was a killer. And so I always marvel at the footage, both still footage and film footage of the 1918-1919 pandemic, and the Army Medical Corps efforts to contain influenza and its killing, and the images of people both in military hospitals and on the streets of New York and Boston and Philadelphia and elsewhere wearing masks everywhere where they went, and the fear in their eyes, and I could only reflect on that I never thought I'd see a day where people would be masked up, that everybody mm-hmm. in the population would be wearing. So we all had to wear masks. We all had to socially distance. There was a great deal of confusion. There was political uncertainty because the president made COVID a political topic, mm-hmm. and efforts to control the spread of the virus into a political matter. So there are people in the community who were struggling with, what to believe and who to believe. And so you had some people adhering to the restraints and protective orders, and others who were ignoring it. So it was a very confusing time, a very scary time. I would say that I haven't seen fear like that on a large scale in my lifetime, but had I lived in 1918, 1919, would have said I've seen this once before. If you look at the old newspapers from Connecticut in 1918, 1919, they were closing schools, they were closing theaters, they were asking restaurants not to, they were telling people to mask up, they were doing all these things, and there was great resistance to that, to those ideas. There were demonstrations against, restraints of freedom and all those sorts of things. So as is always the case, history repeats itself. And again, what we experienced in 2020 is very much what was experienced here in Connecticut in 1918 and 1919.
You mentioned sort of the depths of fear that people have been experiencing throughout this pandemic and in the one of the earlier 20th century. How have you been determining what feels safe or safer for you at an individual level?
Well, I'm a bit of a queer duck in that regard. I, as a homeopath, I've had a level of confidence that I could treat COVID should I contract it without calamities, that I was safe, I guess is the way to say it. And homeopathy would keep me safe. So my outlook was a bit different. I was really watching the whole thing more out of curiosity, as a curious observer without fear. But I know the people around me, my children and particularly my friends. My children, again, had some confidence because I seemed to have this confidence in homeopathy. My friends were, there was tremendous anxiety, depression, feeling of despair and hopelessness that I hadn't seen before. But I personally didn't feel that way. I was excited to see what homeopathy could do, gratified to see how well patients responded to homeopathy, and confident that if I got the disease, I too would do well under homeopathic care.
What kind of research should people in the humanities and the social sciences be doing right now to help us understand this moment?
Ask the question again.
What kind of research should people in the humanities and the social sciences be doing right now to help us understand this historic moment and the pandemic?
That's an interesting question. I, as a medical historian, which I believe you are, mm-hmm. I think it's important to understand, to try to come to some understanding as to why, I come at everything from a homeopathic perspective, but why you've got a system of medicine that's been around for 200 years, used by about 250,000 physicians worldwide, probably more, and a half a billion patients worldwide. Why is it that at no time during this pandemic did people turn and say, they did have a lot of success in 1918, 1919, and it wasn't just because they weren't giving aspirin. And they had a lot of success in the 19th century. We know that from good health records, reliable health records that were taken in places like Philadelphia and Boston and New York. There's something there. We don't understand it. In fact, we can't seem to find an explanation, and yet it saved lives. Why is it that something potentially is profoundly useful, helpful, inexpensive, could have been distributed on a massive scale in no time at all, would have saved untold numbers of lives and the wreckage of an economy? Why is it that humankind again chose to look the other way or refused or allowed a dominant paradigm, medical paradigm, to control the, to exert such influence and make all the choices and provide all the therapies? If you think about it, if we're correct, if homeopathy could have shorten the duration of these infections, reduce the mortality rate dramatically, and led to, open economies and the free trade and, continuing commerce, all the casualties of this pandemic could have been avoided, or much of the damage of this pandemic could have been avoided. Why is it that you've got all these folks, 250,000 physicians, France, 95% of the physicians in France, pediatricians and general practitioners, use homeopathy in their general practices, their daily practices. How is it that we have this system that was once again completely ignored? Now, I have a thought. It's not a profitable modality. You can't make money on vaccines and drug therapies in homeopathy. The medicines we use are incredibly cheap and readily abundant, easily made and distributed. And so we are of all the paradigms, of all the alternative paradigms, we're the greatest threat to the pharmaceutical industry. I understand all that. But it's still fascinating to me that all the bright people in the world, in the face of this terrible calamity, never looked beyond the current paradigm with any confidence. So that would be one thing I'd want to look at. I'd want to understand why is it that humankind makes the choices it makes, and I would say chooses treasure over lives all too often. So it's maybe an unknowable question to investigate, but it's fascinating to me. You're a brilliant researcher and a medical historian. If you had looked at the data that I've looked at and saw that in epidemics of cholera, diphtheria, yellow fever, scarlet fever, smallpox, influenza, et cetera, you know, they'd wipe out entire neighborhoods. Entire families would die in the 1800s. Entire sections of a town would just disappear from the plagues that would strike. And yet in those places where homeopaths were doing their work, nobody was dying. The mortality rates were a tiny, tiny fraction of what they were under ordinary care. And you then discovered that it had nothing to do with, you know, again, one of the great arguments that they like to make in current times is, well, the guys in the 1800s were using heroic forms, you know, giving mercury and bleeding and doing crazy stuff that was obviously going to kill people. And that's why homeopaths did better. But what if you discovered that the untreated did almost as poorly as those treated with ordinary medicine? And yet again, the people treated with homeopathy didn't die. What questions would you ask? And I think that's where I am. You know, it's just, right. If you look at the data, and that's what drives me. If you look at the data, it says one thing, and yet here we are faced with a global pandemic with catastrophic results, and nobody bothered to look at the data that showed there was a different path. So those are the questions that I would wrestle with. I doubt anybody will, but that's what I'm fascinated by.
Thank you so much for your time. My last question is just to ask if there is a particularly COVID-19-esque anecdote from your personal experience that you think casts light on sort of the everyday life under COVID.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by that?
So some people have given examples around Zoom birthday parties, weddings not attended, family gatherings, losing work, finding more work, those kinds of things.
For me, and I say with some emotion, it's losing family members unable to say goodbye. Mm-hmm.
What would you want historians who never lived in this moment, so a generation after us, to know about that experience?
What I just said about losing a That's a really difficult question to answer.
Don't have to answer it.
Yeah, no, I would just stay with the comment that I made. If they don't get it based on the words I spoke, then I can't explain it to them. Not to be blunt, but anyway.
Thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else?
No, I would love to know more about your work at some point. This isn't the time to get into it, but I would love to read a paper or two that you've written or understand. I've done some, you know, background research on you and the things that you're interested in, but I I hope someday to be able to read some of your work.
That's very kind. Thank you.
All right, Kit. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.